I'm Steve Elliott with GrassFire.org, and I invite you to join the resistance, a patriotic, conservative resistance to Barack Obama's big government agenda. Go to ResistObamaNow.com and join more than 250,000 citizens who are standing shoulder to shoulder in this grassroots resistance. You and I are the last line of defense against Obama's rapid move to socialism. Go to ResistObamaNow.com. That's ResistObamaNow.com.
Morning, Gordon, evening, Grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. It's the week that I take off each year, the week after Christmas, and I am long gone. But you don't have to worry, because I found a seasoned radio pro who's willing to take over this microphone and even work with Adam and Dwayne to make sure that all the news of the day, and yes, there is news this week, gets reported well. Mark Eisler has been holding down radio microphones in Southern California for many, many years. He's a pro. He's one of us. He's a great conservative. Take it away, Mark Eisler, and welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Mark Eisler sitting in for you, Hewitt, and I didn't agree to Adam and Dwayne. Was that in the contract? I don't remember that. But I did agree to our guest now, Congressman Ed Royce. Republican Congressman Ed Royce will soon be starting his ninth term in Congress, representing Southern California's 40th District, based in Orange County. The congressman serves as a senior member of two important committees in the House, Foreign Affairs and Financial Services. And as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, he is the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Terrorism, Nonproliferation, and Trade. Congressman, welcome. And the only reason you're back on again is because you said good things about me the last time you were on.
Well, Mark, good to be with you again.
Listen, you're the perfect guest to have on now. I'm really concerned, as everybody, I think, is about the conflict between Israel and Hamas. And the Israeli leaders are calling this a war to the end, I guess, huh?
Well, and I must tell you, there's a certain lesson in this, because Israel, as you know, withdrew its soldiers, its settlers from Gaza, turned that over to the Palestinian Authority, and Hamas won control of the internal power there. And since that point in time, we've seen over 6,000 rockets fired onto civilians, killing and injuring over 800. So this is what Israel is confronted with today. And certainly it's hard to focus the media's attention. They only seem to pay attention when Israel responds to the Hamas barrages. But
that is such a great
killing the economy of southern Israel.
That is such a great point. Of course, when all the rockets were fired in, I didn't hear a word, did you? I mean, other than...
Let me tell you a quick story here about the media's focus on this issue, because I was actually over in Israel in August of 2006 during the Hezbollah attacks there and the rocket attacks. And I went into one of the towns that was under assault and actually witnessed an attack. I was actually in a bunker when the missiles hit outside. And I tried to get a reporter there who had interviewed me maybe 30 minutes before that to come down to Rambam Hospital. I'd gone into the hospital, and there were hundreds of civilians in there that had been hit by these rockets that were fired by Hezbollah at the time. And they had little ball bearings, maybe 80,000 ball bearings in the head of each rocket. And you can imagine what that did to the civilian population. They were shooting them right into the town. Mm-hmm. And I could not convince the reporter. She said, "I'd like to do the story, but my editor has told me that that's not balanced." Instead, her stories were on the counter barrage that the Israeli military were undertaking against the rockets, which were being, frankly, launched from people's backyards. And then they take out the yard, and that would be the story. That would be the footage, rather than going into the hospital there. So I'm quite concerned about the lack of balance in the media reporting of this.
I'm sure they're going to come out with the phrase, if they haven't already, cycle of violence, right? As if it's just both sides just killing each other. It doesn't matter who's the bad guys, who are the good guys.
Yeah, exactly. Proportional response. And I think when you hear that, what people forget, and the targets that Israel just hit were Hamas's public security installation, their graduation ceremony for their terrorists there got hit. They took out their intelligence headquarters, their training base for their terrorist brigades. We're all taken out. But people forget what's going on in the society, because young children there are, you know, getting up in the morning, turning on Hamas television aimed at them, and they have a little kid come out with a rabbit costume that's on every day. And that Hamas bunny advocates martyrdom to those kids. The little rabbit, little cartoon characters do the same thing. They tell the kids, your job is to prepare for martyrdom. You know, as their leader said, the Islamic nation is going to sit on the throne of the world. This is not a figment of our imagination, but a fact. Tomorrow, Allah Akbar, we're going to lead the world. Allah is greater than America. And the most important issue is jihad. You know, jihad is the solution. It's the only solution. It's the path. So here's a society now that is learning that and then practicing it by launching these attacks on civilians. And in this kind of environment, the Israeli authorities have the responsibility of taking out these rocket launchers and the people firing them.
And yes, I'm going to paraphrase Golda Meir. Didn't she say something, you know, that if they cared more about life, they don't, right? They don't care so much about life, and we've got that problem. We care about life, and death is looked at in a different way than our societies do, so we have that issue also.
Well, we have that issue in the sense that Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's an outshoot of that ideology that believes in one Islamic state. Jerusalem would be the fountainhead or the capital of that state. And what their charter says is that Allah is the goal, the Prophet is the model, the Quran is our constitution, and jihad, the path, and death for the cause of Allah is the most sublime belief. Now that's a short charter, a short manifesto for Hamas, but it tells quite a story. If that's your goal, if there's no solution except by jihad, if that's what you're commanded to do by your ideology, and you're going to raise your children watching cartoons that promote martyrdom, and you're going to march your children around in fake suicide vests, then I think we can see that, you know, it's going to be rather difficult to get a solution to this. Indeed, I think the only course of action right now that can be pursued is to take out those rocket launchers, as we've discussed. That's what's happening as we speak.
You see, I'm one. I was never in favor of Israel giving back the Gaza. I think Israel hasn't gone in strong enough in the past, and the United States may have held them back. Do you think that's part of the issue?
I don't know if the United States held them back. As I say, I was in Haifa during the attacks there that were being conducted by Hezbollah, and Nasrallah was, ranting on the television, and I watched the response because shortly after, while I was there, Israel responded. Now, not with an effective enough campaign to really take out Hezbollah along the border there, and we found out later one of the reasons was because Iranian agents were down there, and they had, frankly, shown the Hezbollah operatives how to dig tunnels deeper than the munitions would strike, and so they were actually able to wait out the counter-battery offensive by Israel and then come up through the tunnels in the middle of the action. And what's interesting is that some of the officers, they showed me ID badges that came from Iranian military people. And the man who conducted that operation, Karani, General Karani down there, his brother was also a Iranian agent for Hezbollah who came over the border of the U.S. in the trunk of a car, came over the Mexican border after bribing officials, and he was actually arrested up in Detroit. He's serving time in federal penitentiary now with 52 of his associates who were in a cell, a Hezbollah cell here in the U.S. So Hezbollah and Hamas, both driven by this radical jihadist ideology, are really a problem, not only anymore for just Israel, but increasingly for the region and for the U.S.
And as you mentioned, Iran's fingerprints are on all of this, huh?
Iran's fingerprints are on it, and, you know, this was the week when there was a lot of pressure on Iran by the diplomatic corps around the world to come to the table in terms of its nuclear weapon systems. And instead, we see this diversion of the launch of 300 rockets on southern Israel, and it certainly has taken the attention away from the issue of Iranians' development of atomic weaponry, and put it back on this issue here of Hamas. And
Congressman,
I think we've got to stay focused on where Iran's headed with us.
You're going to stay with us another segment, right?
Absolutely.
And we'll take your calls for Congressman Ed Royce, 1-800-520-1234. Mark Eisler sitting in for you, Hewitt. Mark Eisler sitting in for you, Hewitt. And my special guest is Congressman Ed Royce. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Mark.
How do you think this is all going to end? I mean, it's...
Well, you know, this is worrying because it's not just happening among the Palestinians that are being influenced by Hamas. The same phenomenon is occurring right now across Pakistan as you watch these schools, for instance, the one run by the LET, by the terrorist group, that back in 2001 attacked the Parliament of India. That particular organization has trained thousands of young men that have gone back to Britain. And Scotland Yard reported that there's about 4,000 British Muslims that have received training at terrorist camps inside Pakistan that are now back in country. And in the meantime, you know, we've had the arrest of Richard Reed, who tried to blow up a plane with explosives in his shoe.
Sure.
We've had our own problem here in the U.S. with 11 LET terrorists who were in Virginia, who had gone to Pakistan for training, had come back and were training with what paint guns you call them, when they were arrested and found to be part of a cell group here. And lastly, you've got the attack on Mumbai, where you saw the carnage created, and sure enough, the fellow in custody admits he was trained by the LET, by this jihadist group with links to Al-Qaeda, specifically to try to create maximum damage in the financial capital, the financial hub of India, the old Bombay. So we see this phenomenon where a young generation are being taught hate. And I think it's very important for the public to understand exactly what's afoot here. We can have leaders on the world stage like Zardari of Pakistan. He called them terrorists, and he talked to them as wolf packs and said, you know, that they have to be closed down. But the reality is that in these societies, these forces are becoming so powerful that just as his wife was killed by the terrorists, just as the former prime minister was killed, and as Musharraf faced three attacks on his life, so now they're worried that Zardari will be taken out by terrorists. And so this is the state of the world we live in today, where I think seeing the world as it really is important.
How do we defeat this, Congressman? I mean, I know you don't have any easy answers. I think the American people during the campaign may not have wanted to hear any more about it. But as you point out, this is huge. I mean, this is widespread. How do we defeat this?
Well, think about this. One of the ways you defeat it is by listening into the telephone conversations that began overseas in Pakistan or in Afghanistan or in Beirut. Think about the fact that we have, coming in as Attorney General Eric Holder, an individual who's been on the other side of this argument, arguing that because when that phone call is made, you don't know if there's a chance that that terrorist organization might call someone in the United States, not necessarily a citizen here, you know, maybe an agent here, but the argument is, by the ACLU, by Eric Holder, as long as that individual is in the U.S., his inalienable rights are being violated unless you get a warrant first before you tap that line. Well, to do this in real time, when you're trying to monitor Al-Qaeda's operations and Hezbollah's operations, and you're using that data in order to pass it on to the British and French and German and U.S. intelligence services in order for them to intercept these organizations, these cell groups, and prevent death, to have the ACLU and our new incoming Attorney General obsessed with the idea that somewhere along the line, there might be somebody already here who gets the phone call, and that would be a violation of rights. And therefore, you know, we should shut down that kind of an operation. And on top of it, we should allow lawsuits against AT&T and other companies that cooperate with our NSA, with our intelligence services, in order to protect the security of the United States. This is the struggle that we've got. And the media is not going to talk a lot about this, but think about it for 1 minute, Mark. We have been able, since 9/11, by using aggressive surveillance overseas, not here. This is tapping these lines overseas. We have been able to stop these attacks. But if the new administration insists on the ACLU's position on this and releases everybody from Guantanamo, by the way, a dozen of them have shown back up on the battlefield, shooting again at American troops in Afghanistan. So, you know, if that's the tack we're going to take, then we're not going to have the kinds of success that we've had in keeping this at bay so far. And I must add one thing to this. We tipped off the Indian government, and I'm sorry that the bureaucracy there wasn't a little more effective, but we tipped off that government about the attacks to come on Mumbai. And one of the lessons of the Mumbai attack, which was particularly savage, is that we've got to have a lot quicker response. And fortunately, we have been good at being able to get human intelligence and getting intel that allows us to take decisive action.
I think you answered my next question. Are you worried, and do you think Obama's up to the task? You're obviously worried.
Well, we can't know if he's up to the task because he hasn't had any experience in any of this. So he's going to have to learn on the job. I mean, he's been running for president since he got to the United States Senate.
What do you mean, Congressman? So, he was a community organizer.
Yeah,
wasn't that experience?
He does have that background. Yeah. You know, but our problem here is that in terms of foreign policy, we have a dedicated foe who not only hates us, but more importantly, hates the concept of democracy. If one believes that law should only come from Allah and that a democratic system in and of itself is evil, then they intend obviously not only to topple governments in Western Europe if they could, and the Middle East. You know, it's democracy itself that they see as an affront. Yep. And comprehending this is important for understanding what drives, you know, groups like Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, the wider jihadi network out there. And after 9/11, we don't have the luxury anymore of saying border security is not important. We don't have the ability, after the first attack on the World Trade Center, when we suddenly realized that two of the individuals that carried out that first attack, that bombing attack on the Trade Center, had gotten amnesty, had been here illegally and gotten amnesty. With the kinds of problems we have right now with these cell groups, it is very unwise to begin to move towards an open borders position.
Congressman Royce, as always, very informative. We'll have you back again. You're terrific in enlightening us. We have a real serious problem. We'll take your calls and other guests to come. Mark Eisler sitting in for UU. Mark Eisler sitting in for UU. My number is 1-800-520-1234. For the people waiting a long time, I promise to get to you eventually. I do apologize. But we have a terrific columnist on. Jeff Jacoby has been an op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe since February 1994. The Boston Phoenix has dubbed his twice-weekly essays a must-read, describing him as a preeminent spokesman for conservative nation. Jeff, I had shows here in Los Angeles from 10 to 1. I always wanted to have you on, but let's see, that would have been like 1 to 4 your time. I never asked you to come on.
Hey, we'll figure out a way to make it happen. Can I just tell you that life in Boston has been gray and dismal ever since the station that was carrying the Salem talk show hosts switched to a Spanish language Christian music format. So it's been months now since I've been able to hear Hugh Hewitt or Dennis Prager or any of the great Salem guys on the radio in Boston.
Well,
I'm glad you're calling tonight. It gives me a chance to to hear what you're talking about.
Yeah, the fact that I won't ever be on again, that's another story that you knocked there, change your format. But I really do appreciate you, and I've admired you for a long time.
Thank you.
I don't know if the column that you just came out was the one that struck me today. Don't believe everything you read. You may not have heard our first hour since you can't listen. I was talking about I don't trust Obama. I mean, he parses his words, and whatever he says, you know, he may be on the other side tomorrow. Who knows what he believes, because people took whatever he said to be what they wanted him to be.
Right, but at least everybody knows that Barack Obama is a politician, and everybody knows that politicians' words ought to be taken with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
What I tried to write about in this latest column was those of us in the, you know, in the supposed expertise business, the pundits, the commentators, the analysts, the experts, who will issue these pronouncements and these predictions and these explanations about what has happened, what it means, and what's going to happen tomorrow and next week and next month with absolute 100% certainty, and then turn out to be dead wrong. And it, you know, it just occurred to me that this, you know, that once every 15 years, they ought to do a column pointing out that even people like me should have our words taken with a grain of salt, because we don't always get these things right either. You know, it's there's a great hunger on the part of many people to believe in experts, to be able to hang mm-hmm. your faith on the words of somebody who supposedly knows what he's talking about. And a lot of people make a lot of money by holding themselves out as people who know what they're talking about. And it's just worth remembering now and then, you know, an awful lot of people will say things with great adamant, you know, it's fervor and insistence, and then turn out to be dead wrong.
And I have one of yours right here. I guess this was from Business Week, the list. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg will enter the presidential race in February. I guess we missed that. After it becomes clear which nominees will get the nod from the major parties, his multiple billions in organization will impress voters and stun rivals. He'll look the most... You should almost read this is yours. He'll be as viable as since Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, that's just one of many, right?
And that was just one. You know, that was one prediction that Business Week made a year ago. And yeah, I mean, you read half of it, and it keeps on going. And they got every single detail wrong. It wasn't as though they got some of it right and some of it wrong. You can't even say, well, they got the big thing wrong. You know, Bloomberg didn't enter the presidential race, but they got everything else right. They got it all wrong, including ending up with the conclusion that John McCain was going to be the country's next president and that Hillary Clinton was going to be the Democratic nominee. And you can find stuff like this. You know, I started keeping a predictions file. And, you know, it's wonderful sometimes to just pull it out of the file cabinet and look back. For example, I just, you know, sitting here waiting to come on with you, I pulled out of my file. From the Chronicle of Higher Education, September 2000, political prognosticators agree Gore will win the White House in November. And, you know, it's not a modern phenomenon. Obviously, people getting things wrong goes back a long ways, but so does this phenomenon of people, especially those of us in the media, you know, acting as though we've got a pipeline to greater wisdom and insight than everybody else. My own newspaper... I'm not going to get myself in trouble for this because...
What do you mean? You got me in trouble. Why not get you in trouble?
This is 108 years old, so it's. I don't think anybody's going to be steaming over it. The Boston Globe, on January 1st, 1901, the first day of the 20th century, had a front-page editorial in which it kind of surveyed the landscape of the world. It took the temperature of the world scene, and it was making predictions on what was going to happen in the 20th century. And it has a paragraph here where it talks about Germany. And it says, of all the nations, she is probably the least corrupted by the lust of conquest.
Unbelievable.
Now, can you imagine, looking back from the perspective of, you know, the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, with the knowledge of World War One and World War Two and the extraordinary havoc that Germany, you know, wrought on the world. But here was the Boston Globe telling its readers quite firmly in 1901, Germany is a peace-loving country. Of all the countries in the world, that's the one you've got the least.
You know what this means? I was going to ask you to stay on the next segment, but I can't believe anything you have to say. Jeff Jacoby, hold on with us from the Boston Globe. Mark Eisler filling in for you, Hewitt, 1-800-520-1234 with your calls. Mark Eisler filling in for you, Hewitt, and you can reach me at markeisler@AOL.com, markeisler@AOL.com. My guest is Jeff Jacoby, and he's a... How did they reach you, Jeff? How did they reach your column?
Well, you can go to the Boston Globe website. You can come to my website, jeffjacoby.com. And if anybody listening wants to get a copy of the column we're talking about, they can also just send me a note, jacoby@globe.com. put Hugh Hewitt in the subject line, and I'll be glad to send it off to them.
And you are very gracious. You came on short notice, and my producer just said, oh, he's good. I don't want to insult him too much. He didn't know who you were. I said, oh, he's a great guy. What do you mean you don't know who he is? But I want to challenge you a little bit, see if you like what I came up with.
Okay.
It's an easy thing. I thought of the other day that Caroline Kennedy, instead of being appointed to the Senate, we could solve a lot of problems, because I think, you probably didn't hear the first hour, I think Barack Obama thought he was running for president, not president. And so he was a little worried, I think, that he got elected. So, and we could solve the problem with the governor of Illinois. My producer sees what I'm about to get to. Why don't we appoint Caroline as president? Barack could take back his old Senate seat. Uh-huh. And then it doesn't matter. Inexperience doesn't seem to matter at all. Then the liberals can have their Camelot back again. We have a good, you know, the senator back in Illinois. No issue with who the governor appoints. What do you think that as a deal?
You know, I can think of worse prospects than Caroline Kennedy as president. You know, I got to tell you, this whole, I realize this is veering off subject, but this beating up of Caroline Kennedy that's been going on these last few days. You know, the New York Daily News, including every and you know, when it wrote about her interview with them the other day. I got to tell you, speaking as somebody who has lived in Massachusetts for 25 years and seen Kennedys up close, I would gladly take Caroline Kennedy instead of Ted Kennedy, instead of Patrick Kennedy, the congressman from Rhode Island, instead of Joe Kennedy, the former congressman from Massachusetts. You know,
wait a second. I was serious. I would take her instead of Barack Obama.
That's what I agree with you.
Okay.
I can think of worse things than Caroline Kennedy as president instead of Barack Obama. And there's a lot less damage to be done by, you know, by a senator, by another 6 years of a Senator Obama than another 4 or 8 years of a President Obama.
So can I write a column for the Boston Globe?
I think you got to do more than just come up with one idea.
Oh,
you know what?
But wait,
okay,
that's
with me. You write that column and I'll tack it up on the bulletin board.
I hate to tell you, that was it for me. I just wanted one column idea. I'll leave that stuff to you guys. So after what they did to Sarah Palin, I mean, what they're doing to Caroline Kennedy seems like a double standard almost.
I heard from a number of people, some of them surprisingly liberal, Democratic liberals, who wrote to say you really ought to write something about the treatment of Sarah Palin versus the treatment of Caroline Kennedy. But before I had a chance to write anything, the treatment of Caroline Kennedy has turned incredibly negative. I have to admit, I'm surprised by how hostile it's gotten.
Why do you think that's going on?
I'm mystified by it. I really am mystified by it. I'm not sure if it's a reaction to what's going on in Illinois, and therefore anybody who's being bruited about as someone to be appointed senator by a governor is seen as suspect.
I got an idea. You know what it just hit me? Maybe they're very defensive because of Obama, so it's hitting home, and they figure, well, now we could feel free to attack inexperience.
Some of it, of course, may be. She was a Hillary person who became an Obama person. There might be a lot of embittered Hillary supporters, you know, former Hillary supporters who don't like the idea of seeing Hillary's seat being given to somebody who became a prominent booster of Barack Obama. Mm. That's a possibility. Maybe there's a lot of resentment on the left by those who think she hasn't been in the trenches, pushing that MoveOn.org bus out of the ditch and doing everything she can to advance the leftist agenda. And, you know, who is she to be given a seat in the U.S. Senate? I'm not sure. I think some of it may just simply be, you know, good old-fashioned envy.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I repeat, having seen what other Kennedys are like when they're in office, I have a strong feeling that Caroline Kennedy would do a lot less damage.
Yeah, and she didn't even vote for any candidates, let alone Democrats, right?
And didn't donate a lot of money to the Democratic Party.
Yeah. And speaking of the Clintons, you recently wrote, whatever happened to the fresh progressive candidate who promised an escape from Clinton-era Democratic politics? We had a lot of Clinton Democrats in the cabinet.
And not to mention, we've even got there's one Bush Republican in there as well. Yeah, there are a lot of people on the left who are very annoyed at the moment with Barack Obama. I think that a lot of them are feeling something akin to what conservative Republicans felt when George Bush Sr. became president and the politics that he began to pursue, the policies he began to promote, weren't those that many on the right were expecting him to promote. Or when he picked somebody, people for the cabinet who weren't seen as good, strong movement conservatives. You know, we both understand it. If you've got strong ideological opinions and a strong political worldview, whether it's on the right or on the left, and you put heart and soul into getting somebody elected president, you feel a little bit betrayed when that person then becomes a president-elect who starts acting, at least at the beginning, as though he's president of more than just the most extreme segment of the base. It's normal politics. I would say the conservatives and Republicans shouldn't be gloating too much about it, because the louder the noise gets from the left, the louder the clamor of disgruntled liberals becomes, as Obama does this, the more it's going to make it possible for him to push back and resist pressure from the right and from the center to do the kinds of things that we'd like to see him do.
And I'm sure,
it works both ways.
And I'm sure paycheck protection is coming, and I don't know about the fairness doctrine. I don't like, obviously, he's far from infanticide. His position on that is very disturbing.
I mean, he said quite explicitly in the campaign that his first priority as president would be to sign the Freedom of Choice Act. Now, if he was just saying it to win votes, and he doesn't really mean it, that would be great. On the other hand, these days, everything is on the record, and it's on YouTube, and there's video and audio of him saying these things. He's going to need, I think, as a very strong left-leaning Democrat, he's going to need pressure from the left to be able to overcome the resistance on the part of much of the country, which for the most part is not left-wing, in order to get some of his agenda enacted. I heard a story. I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but I heard a story about
FDR. Can you hold that story?
Sure.
Can we keep you on another segment?
Absolutely.
Dinner wasn't going to be that good, was it?
What's that?
Dinner wasn't going to be that good, was it?
Not to worry.
My guest is columnist Jeff Jacoby from the Boston Globe. We'll eventually take your calls at 1-800-520-1234. I'm Mark Eisler, sitting in for UU. This is Mark Eisler, filling in for UU. And my guest is a terrific guy, Jeff Jacoby from the Boston Globe. And how do they read your thing? I guess from the Boston Globe, right? Jeff?
BostonGlobe.com. That's one way to find it. Or go to my website. It's JeffJacoby.com. I was sitting waiting, the marvel of Google, I began to tell you a story just at the end of your last segment, and I wasn't sure if it was apocryphal or not, and here I am, I found it on the website. Listen to this. President Franklin Roosevelt recognized that his ability to push New Deal legislation through Congress depended on the pressure generated by protesters. He once told a group of activists who sought his support for legislation, "You've convinced me. Now go out and make me do it."
Hmm.
And, I'm just suggesting that while there's a little bit of schadenfreude on the part of conservatives who are sort of enjoying being able to sit back and watch the liberal Democratic president-elect take some heat from his supporters on the left who don't think he's being liberal enough, or who don't like the fact that he's acting as though conservatives and even Republicans are people, too, we shouldn't get too happy about the pressure that's building up on that side of the political spectrum,
mm-hmm.
because he's going to be able to use that pressure in order to advance his agenda. Politics, it works that way. The pressure that sometimes comes from a president's own supporters can, end up being used in order to enable him to advance his own agenda. So it might be fun to see him getting a little bit of heat, but it's not going to be all that much fun for us either.
That's a great point. We don't have too much time left, but I was not a McCain supporter. I mean, my producer would tell you, I went from person to person to person, went to Romney at the end, and we get someone who doesn't really buy into all of our principles. We're going to have a big battle in the Republican Party for the soul of the party.
Absolutely. And you know what? I don't think that having a turn in the wilderness is the worst thing in the world for a party. I don't think that having battles over fundamental principles and ultimate issues is the worst thing in the world for a political movement, especially after having had 8 years of control of the executive branch and, however many years it was from the election of 94 until, was it 96?
Mm-hmm.
So more than a decade of control of Congress. Republicans, a lot of them moved away from their fundamental principles and the core values that brought them into politics in the first place. They forgot what it was that made them Republicans or what it was that made them conservatives. They began acting more and more like politicians. It's one of the, it's one of the flaws of democracy. And, we are constantly reminded of that wisdom of Churchill. Democracy is the worst form of government that there is, except for all the other forms of government that have been tried from time to time. So losing elections is part of the system, and I think it's part of what keeps democracy being better than all those other systems. Let's make the most of it.
Now, you don't know this, but I guess I did my part because I lost a lot of elections. Oh, you're supposed to win occasionally. Okay. That's what it is. Jeff Jacoby.
That does help, too.
It does help. You've been a terrific guest. Thanks for coming on short notice. We appreciate you very much in the Boston Globe. Mark Eisler filling in for you, Hewitt, and we'll take your calls, 1-800-520-1234.
I'm Steve Elliott with GrassFire.org, and I invite you to join the resistance, a patriotic, conservative resistance to Barack Obama's big government agenda. Go to ResistObamaNow.com and join more than 250,000 citizens who are standing shoulder to shoulder in this grassroots resistance. You and I are the last line of defense against Obama's rapid move to socialism. Go to resistobamanow.com. That's resistobamanow.com.